Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 14, Feedback, Follow-Ups, and the Beginning of Batman.
Batman. The purpose of Shortbox Showcase is to talk about comic-related topics that fall outside of our individual podcasts.
We are going to start our occasional series on Batman in this episode, but first, we review some of the praises our dear listeners have lavished upon us.
And talk about this past weekend's OhioCon.
Wanted to thank Ed Moore for leaving our latest iTunes review. We have an email from Ed as well, so we'll tell you all about his podcasts and efforts shortly. In terms of email feedback, wanted to thank Ron Sadowski, who sent us some nice encouraging words. That was a few months ago. That was the email that came in, I think, the day after we recorded our last feedback episode.
Oh, unfortunate.
So it's been in the email bag for quite some time. But It's been on the bottom of the pile, but I've mentioned Ron on the Quarterbin podcast, so he has gotten his props.
Back in the emails, we got one from Robert Ward, who emailed us to talk about his love for our White Tiger episode and to decry how sad it was that it's one of our lowest downloaded episodes.
It's a sad, sad episode. All by itself, at the bottom of the listings, kind of like Ron Sadowski's email, the bottom of the email bag.
Well, they can be like digital message pen pals or something.
Exactly.
He says, as someone trying to get back into comics, this time nice and properly, I really enjoy hearing people gush about comics they love and recommend highly. White Tiger, simply put, is one of those titles that is nowhere near my radar and probably would not have come to my attention if not for Relatively Geeky. However, thanks to you, I have a new title to add to my list and I'm eagerly waiting to get it. Everything just clicked in what I like or would like in a comic, and the enthusiasm that the show was delivered in was pretty infectious and leaves me personally waiting for the next random spotlight. Keep up the good work, Robert.
Well, we do have some random spotlights coming up this year.
Or maybe not so random spotlights, as the case may be.
Yes, Random is my other show. The Quarterbin Podcast, also available on this feed at the Relatively Geeky Network.
I shake my head at you.
Obviously, we're going to be doing some Batman-themed episodes this year, but sprinkled in between those will be plenty of discussions of comics you've probably never heard of, or never thought you would ever want to buy, or listen to two people talk about. But hopefully our enthusiasm will be infectious. Infectious in the good way.
Yes. Like infectious lass.
That's not the good way.
No.
I mentioned earlier Ed Moore, and Ed is the proprietor of Teal Productions, which does a whole bunch of podcasts, some related to comics, some related to other pop culture things, and some he does solo, some he does with his wife, some he does with a son. So it's a nice family network of podcasts. Huh.
We are all about that.
Exactly. And Ed recently went through our back catalog, so he had a comment on Shortbox Showcase number 8. Which was one of our 60 Comics Everyone Should Read episodes. And what he said was pretty short and to the point.
Every single person that is a fan of sequential art should read Lone Wolf and Cub. Those that are already fans of it should listen to the Ronin Rabbit podcast.
The Ronin Rabbit is one of his many podcasts. This one focuses on Osagi Yojimbo and other aspects of manga. I confess, I listen to many of Ed's podcasts, not that one.
Well, maybe once you read an issue of Usagi, you might get interested. Who knows?
But I do thoroughly recommend it nonetheless. And we've gotten some feedback on last episode on cons and cosplay. One was a Facebook conversation with Steve J. Rogers, which was pretty much his running commentary of the episode. At one point, he followed up and wanted to make sure that CPA conventions have hijinks and shenanigans, which unfortunately I had to say, no, they actually don't. He then mentioned, in particular, the story that Emily told about Sticker Shock buying items at conventions. Those are not exactly bargain basement prices.
No.
Steve told a story about a HeroCon in the late 90s, with a bunch of Star Trek actors and so on, he wanted to know if there was a price discount for people who just didn't want to go to the con but just wanted to go through the vendor's aisles. And he was told in no uncertain terms, no, that's not the way the tickets worked. And actually, you mentioned, Emily, that OhioCon changed their ticketing a little bit this year, making it more difficult to share tickets and so forth.
Yeah, the original plan was that myself and about 8 other people were all going to be sharing a house at one of our friends' places who lives right by the convention center so that we didn't have to get hotels. Saves you a lot of money that way. But then, further to save money, we planned that most of us didn't really want to go to panels. We just sort of wanted to go to the convention and just hang out with each other. So only about 4 or 5 of us were actually going to buy badges. The way it used to work was that you had a badge that was hang on a lanyard, and that was your ticket to get into a panel. And then, for our friends that only wanted to go to 1 or 2 panels in particular, if someone else wasn't in a panel, you could just lend them your badge for an hour, and then they'd come and find you again. They got wise to this last year, apparently, because this year it was more like a music festival or something where you had to go in and you had to get a wristband put on. And you, when you bought your ticket at the registration booth, they sat there and made sure you put it on and locked it on your wrist. You couldn't even buy a friend's ticket if a friend wasn't coming, which actually happened to us at one point. We tried to get her ticket and give it to one of our friends, and they were not having any of that either.
Yeah, you had a friend who had bought a ticket and was not going to be able to attend.
Yeah, she had to cancel.
And a friend who wanted to attend but had yet to buy a ticket, and somehow that situation could not be, ticket from the one could not be transferred to the other.
They've gotten a lot stricter. You have to have registration confirmation and a photo ID and look like your photo ID and put it on right there. So even if our friend Amanda had come and gotten her ticket, she could not have gone outside of the hall and given it to somebody else. She would have had to put it on right there. So.
Now, in terms of having to look like your photo ID, what does that do for the cosplayers?
Yeah, exactly. Just put your cosplay on afterwards.
We got feedback from faithful listener and podcaster extraordinaire, Mike Bailey, about the cons and cosplay episode. And first thing, he thanks us right off the bat for making his administrative and operational work a little more bearable. He says, our shows are always top-notch, and it's nice to have this to listen to on a Saturday morning when I'd rather be spending at home asleep. So, we can advertise that. Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Better than sleep.
Better than silence.
Better than just doing your boring work with nothing in your ears.
I like it.
Then he does go on to tell 2 stories in his email, one sort of related to my experiences and one related to yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think, in general, this is, a lot of our listeners fall into this, where they're older than you but younger than me.
Oh, awesome.
So I think our generational divide is interesting because a lot of other podcasters and listeners,
they're actually in that transition,
I think, are somewhere in the middle between us. Mike tells a story with cons that mirrors my experiences, where the first shows he went to were in hotel lobbies. And he says, my father never really understood my obsession with comics, and I think there were a lot of times he probably wished I'd move on to something else, but he was the one that drove me to these shows, similar to my mom driving me to shows. I would see a notice in one of the comics about an upcoming one-day con, and he would be the one to figure out where it was and how to get me there. So while he may not have understood or even liked that his son was into Superman, he was a good enough dad to take me where I wanted to go.
Aww.
He actually came into the show with me as well, probably because he wanted to make sure that I wasn't being taken advantage of either by the dealers or by some skeevy comic book fan. Dad and I never saw eye to eye on a lot of things, but he loved his son enough to put up with all the trappings of comic book fandom in the late 80s and early 90s.
Aww, again.
That's actually a pretty heartwarming story.
Yeah.
He also talks about an experience that was similar to yours, Emily.
Comedic double booking.
Wondering whether he was in the right place or not. Back in 1995, I went to my one and only Star Trek convention with the girl I was dating at the time and her little brother. Well, sometimes that's what you have to do. We drove into the parking lot of the convention center, and my spider sense immediately began tingling. There were a lot of pickup trucks with gun racks and NRA stickers. Now, I'm not making a judgment call on such things because, frankly, I could care what someone drives or what organization they belong to, but Star Trek fans always seemed a rather non-truck with a gun rack and NRA sticker on it type of crowd.
Unless it's for the Night Vale NRA.
Oh.
Oh, yes.
I commented on this, and my girlfriend thought it was strange as well. When we walked into the front, all became clear. There was a sign that informed us that upstairs was the Star Trek convention, downstairs was the gun show. So yeah, sometimes double booking of a place leads to comedy gold.
That's fantastic.
Of course, if I know some of the fellas who were probably at the comic convention, there was a gun show going on there too, if you know what I'm saying.
Actually, no.
No, not probably not. Probably not.
The cheerleaders were back this year. I felt really bad for them.
Well, for one thing, it was like 15 degrees and snowy.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's, I will say that the cheerleaders and most people at the convention were wearing about the same amount of clothes. Not nearly enough when the weather is 5 degrees.
One follow-up I did to Mike was I did remind him that, to be fair to the NRA, I do imagine they are probably very pro-phaser.
Oh, it's true.
So I think we can find common ground between
some
Star Trek and the National Rifle Association. Now, Emily, you talked a wee little bit about OhioCon this year.
Yes.
So overall, what was your experience?
Well, this year was a little bit odd because I think this is probably the best time that I have had at a convention in quite a while. But it was also the year I did the least as far as actual convention activities. I wasn't involved in any photo shoots. I didn't even go to very many panels. I met 2 voice actors, and I went to the dealers and artists alley rooms like once. So most of the time I was actually just sort of hanging out in hallways or back at our home base house. It was a couple blocks away from the center.
So it was much more hanging out with like-minded buddies than actually doing con-related things.
Right. And this was because the OhioCon schedule has always been a little bit wonky. I mentioned this when I talked about it the first time, that I had no idea what any of the panels were going to be beforehand because they're not very good at updating the schedule until the day of the convention. And what they do for the convention every year is that when you sign up, you get this pamphlet. And this year it was a newspaper, basically, that had all of the panel rooms and schedules all listed in it. But again, you don't get that until Friday. And up until that, you know, Thursday night, the panel rooms are going to be changing and people are going to be canceling and adding new stuff. So that's always difficult. But this year in particular, they were kind of not very good about making sure that similar panels were not at the same time. That I heard this from a lot of people, that there would be a Tokusatsu and Godzilla panel at the same time. And it's like, well, that doesn't make very much sense. People want to go to both of those. So that happened to a decent degree, so I had to make a lot of tough choices about which stuff I was going to go to because I only wanted to go to 5 panels, and they were in 2 slots.
One of the things you mentioned last episode was your buddies doing a combat class or a combat event of some kind. How did that go?
I actually don't know, because the other part of this was that I was one of the primary drivers. With the weather being the way it was,
cold and snowy.
Yeah, and the timing being what it is, that is, I have to leave before the plows came out and get people to the convention. I didn't really stick around much because I had to drop them off for their panel first, but then I had other errands to do. I had other people to pick up and take to panels. So I was more of a shuttler on that particular day that I drove something like I don't know, 20-some miles over the course of the day, picking up various people and taking them different places. And then I finally actually went to the convention about 3 hours after they got there. It's been videotaped, and I hear it was pretty good. My friend, who was really excited in that, she actually found one of her combat partners from a previous year. And the two of them paired up because they knew each other's style. They knew what each other could do. So I heard it was a fun experience and that they came up with a pretty good fight routine by the end of it. So,
what about the cosplay side? Both, how did your cosplay go?
Mine was excellent. I was actually really proud of myself. It all came together in the end, which I wasn't quite sure was going to happen. I was buying supplies Thursday night, an hour before I went to go and get my badge. And it was a little hectic, but it all came together.
And you tossed together a friend's costume in about 30 minutes. Yes. One night also.
The friend, actually the same one who went to the fight panel, she had recently purchased some corsets, and she really liked her corsets and wanted to wear them to the convention because she didn't have an official costume. Sort of like the thing I said before about, I feel underdressed, I need to go buy a wig, I need a corset, I need a prop of some type just to be a part of the convention. I feel weird being out of costume. And so she called me maybe an hour or two before I was going to go and meet everybody at home base and said, I need you to bring a petticoat and 3 yards of purple fabric. Now, being a costumer, I'm actually kind of used to these sorts of requests, that I get the text and I go, okay, that makes... Wait, why does she want... Oh, right! And
actually, I saw her outfit. It looked really good.
But yeah, in 45-ish minutes or so, we put her in a petticoat. We pinned a bunch of fabric onto the petticoat to make this big, poofy, princess-style skirt. Threw the corset on her, pulled it all together, made sure it was all sitting properly, and it was short enough that she could walk, long enough you wouldn't see her boots, and it looked really nice.
And this year you went as a character a little more well-known. You've been a little more obscure in the past, steampunk versions of this or some items like that, and this time you went and found at least a dozen or so like-minded cosplayers.
Yeah, well, I'd recently gotten into Adventure Time, and so had half of the convention. So I saw a lot of people that were dressed as Finn, a lot of people that were dressed as Fiona, a lot of people dressed as various princesses, Bubblegum, Flame Princess, and a crap load of Marshall Lees, like so many. I'm sure that there was like a Marshall Lee photo shoot where the 37 or so Marshall Lees all got together for a couple of pictures, but I wasn't hanging around enough and wasn't on the forums and the message boards and stuff. But it was definitely interesting. And again, the reason that I picked the costume is the reason a lot of people pick the costume is it's a shirt, jeans, shoes, maybe some gray makeup, maybe some teeth. Done. So if you own a red flannel shirt, you've already got half the costume.
I was going to say, you are well on the way to that costume.
Yeah. It was cheap, it's easy, it's comfy, you know, you're not going to have to do like Ren did and wear a corset all day or have some sort of big dress or huge props. Now, speaking of huge props, I need to give some huge props to several of the convention. Oh, yes, I went there.
I see what you did there, but I don't like it.
I do have to give some serious respect to a couple of cosplayers. Now, every year you've got people that go in what we call sort of floor costumes, just for walking around, stuff like a Marshall Lee outfit or even the purple princessy dress. Like, it's not a specific character and it's not so large or cumbersome or difficult that you need a handler, someone to come and make sure that you're not like knocking people over or destroying property. But this year and every year, there are at least a couple of people on stilts. And I saw one person who was Pyramid Head from Silent Hill.
Right.
And had the huge pyramid helmet and then the long pants. And by long pants, I mean long pants. This guy was up on about 2.5-foot, 3-foot stilts.
Awesome.
Walking through the convention center. So you could just see him moving like this lumbering, menacing creature throughout the convention center.
As he should be.
As he should. So that was cool. And then I do not know what it was from, but there was someone there on all fours who was in this big brown sort of cloak slash jumpsuity type thing and had like a painted white mask for a face. Mm-hmm. And it was this big four-armed creature that, and they were walking around the center as well, getting a lot of pictures, people getting pictures underneath them. Because again, the head and person's body was about 5 or 6 feet off the ground. So people were running underneath them, right, and taking pictures underneath them and stuff like that. So that was really impressive. I'm always sort of impressed by that level of crazy concepts that usually there are a couple people that are in like giant power armor. There's Big Daddy or a Gundam or a Transformer or something like that. I didn't see as many this year, probably because of the weather, that people didn't want super bulky costumes if you had to walk outside for any reason because there was a foot and a half of snow.
You want something that you can get an overcoat over.
Yes, exactly. That if you have to go outside.
And a wool hat on top of your head.
Yeah, there's something you want to be able to wrap a scarf around you or something if you're going to be running to and from. Even if you just have to run out to the ATM or to the McDonald's 2 blocks away, you don't want to have to run to the McDonald's in giant platform shoes and a huge cardboard power armor suit.
I saw, M, that the theme or the mascot for this year's was something called a magical girl, which looks somewhat anime-ish. Explain the concept to an old man.
Well, each year, OhioCon picks a particular theme. This is actually the other reason I didn't go to as many panels. Last year's theme was zombie. The year before that was steampunk. A couple years before that, they did giant robots, you know, stuff like that. And each year they just pick a theme that's sort of similar to like that. Usually it's either a subgenre that has something to do with anime or pop culture, or it's a subgenre specifically of anime and manga. A magical girl is a character that has some sort of power that allows them to transform into a superhero, basically. So they're usually like 13 to 15 year old girls who are sort of just getting into middle school who discover some sort of magic staff or a stone or something that allows them to transform into this super magical, powerful something or other to go and fight crime and evil. The most well known is Sailor Moon, where, you know, you do your spin around dance and your clothes all change and now you've got super sparkly magic powers, that sort of thing. But there are a variety of others, and there's one show that got a couple of panels about it called Madoka Magica, which is a super super dark and edgy version of Sailor Moon that it takes that same concept and is like, All right, well, you're gonna get all these magical powers, except those magical powers actually come from a demon who's like trying to control and destroy you.
So just light reading for
fluffy, fun stuff for your 12 to 15 year old girls, and yeah.
So is that targeted just at that age and gender demographic? For I understand from talking to you, and when we talked to Luke, Jack and Eddie a while back about the different types of manga and anime that were targeted at particular demographics. Are these type of magical girl stories really designed for that demographic?
Yes. I'm just going to say that, yes. A shoujo manga is one that's specifically targeted at sort of 12 to 15 year old girls. That is very much where a magical girl story sort of belongs. Usually. Now that's the thing, is things like Madoka are breaking the conventions. Right. They're more like a deconstruction. So they don't really count as much, but it's basically, here's one for Luke, your henshin heroes, your Ultramans and Sentai, Power Rangers, that sort of thing. If they have a magical ability to do a pose, and then they glow shiny, and they transform, and they have powers. That is the exact same thing that a magical girl is, except a magical girl wears a skirt.
If a convention like OhioCon picks this genre to be the overall theme of the convention, obviously there is more, at least here in the States, there is more draw beyond just the 13 to 15 year old girl.
Yes, there is more of a draw. There are plenty of guys who like Sailor Moon. There are plenty of 35 year old women who like Madoka. It is beyond its intended genre. It's similar to the My Little Pony thing, that it's targeted at girls, but it can be appreciated by boys, men, women.
I was going to compare it in some ways to some of the young adult novels, even though they're intended for people within an age range, can be read by and enjoyed by people of all age ranges. So similar,
right.
Breaking out from that narrow niche.
Yeah, same idea. And again, because it was Magical Girl, that does mean that there was a decent emphasis on the male equivalent, that there were tokusatsu panels. There were several of them. Okay. I went to one of them for Luke, Jack, and Eddie. And it was a really good panel. It was kind of like listening to 24-year-old Luke. That one in particular was about the roots of tokusatsu, and it really talked about the roots of Japanese film and the influence of things like King Kong, what led up to the creation of Godzilla, and how the Godzilla franchise changed from that point, and how the original Godzilla was a pretty dark, serious, contemplative film, and then from that point on they're like, well, we're just going to kind of use it as a little bit of a marketing tool and have someone fighting Godzilla as the movie. And it was really informative, and the guy really knew his chomps about all the different companies and different, this came out here, and then this was this company's reaction to it, and here's someone from Toho, and here's someone from Toei, and they look similar, but this one came first, and then Toei did this, and Toho did this, and back and forth. I actually had a really, really good time at it. I was a little nervous because I had another panel that I wanted to see at that time, and I decided to skip in order to go to the tokusatsu panel. So I was sort of like, okay, this better be good or I'm really going to be pissed.
Impress me. Impress me now.
And it did. Yeah, and that panel ended up being one of only three panels that I went to over the course of the entire weekend. That we got there at 9 or 10 Friday evening, and I left at 5 p.m. on Sunday. Yeah, I only went to two other panels. There was one that was really good. It was a bunch of voice actors getting together and talking. There is a steampunk group that is centered in Columbus who every year come and they have a couple of panels. And so I went to their panel about steampunk anime and what anime has influences of steampunk and vice versa. And that was fun. But most of the time I was hanging out in the hallway with my friends or doing a photo shoot or something like that, or just sort of chilling. We actually would walk actually to my friend's parents' house for dinner, and they would feed us so that we didn't have to eat at the convention because that's expensive.
So no hotel costs, not much in the way of food cost.
Nope, we were on our own for lunch, but other than that, we had breakfast at the house and we had dinner at the parents'. But yeah, a vast majority of the convention was actually, we would leave kind of early. You know, most people stay at a convention until like midnight, 1, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, and then just crash at their hotel room. Well, since we had a little ways to drive, we would go back to the house at like 11 or 12 and then just watch movies until 4 in the morning. So we were still staying up.
You were still on con schedule, but
yeah,
not necessarily at the con.
Exactly. That we sort of had a sub-con going on back at the house. And it very much did feel like a con because there was, including the people who actually lived in the house, I think there were 12 of us with two bathrooms. So we still got that 6-person to a bathroom con experience that is just so central.
And let's just say, in the couple days since you've been back, you've slept really well at night.
Oh my gosh, yes. I got, I think,
there's a bit
9 hours of sleep over the course of the weekend.
So a bit of a sleep deficit you're making up for.
Yeah. Almost always a fallout after a convention. And this year, it was particularly bad, but totally worth it.
Wrap up this portion of the episode. What shopping did you do? And you mentioned recording one of the panels. You also got a little bit of audio as well.
Yes, I picked up a little audio for our show. As I said, OhioCon is really big on having voice actors, and there are several voice actors that are centered in Columbus and who come to the convention every year. Chris Ayers is a fairly well-known voice actor. In addition, Brad Swale comes a lot. There are a couple others who frequently come back. But every single year, Richard Horvitz and Ricky Simons from Invader Zim come and they do autographs and panels and stuff like that. And this year I went up to them. I finally had the nerve to go and talk to them.
You worked up the courage.
It took a little while, but I did it. And I went up and I talked to them for a couple of minutes. And I asked them to give us a little vocal blurb each for Short Box Showcase. So you will be hearing those shortly. I didn't actually do that much shopping, which was something that I sort of plan on each year at OhioCon. I'm like, okay, it's $50 for the ticket, and it's going to be $20 in gas and parking, $20 in food, and like $50 in shopping. And I think I only bought like three things. I bought the first volume of a manga-style comic that someone was there selling. I just love the guy's presentation so much. I'm like, okay, fine, it's $15. Sure, I'll buy the first book. I got a couple of patches because since I started playing D&D, there's one particular booth that shows up each year and they have just little denim patches that have printed on them, you know, paladin, rogue, ranger, villain, hero, NPC. I always liked the NPC badge. But since I am now a game master, I picked up one of those. I was sort of hoping for Capricious God, but you know, that was the closest that they had. And then I picked up a ranger patch for our group's ranger because he couldn't make it to the convention. There are a couple artists who I really like from DeviantArt who are centered in Ohio and go to the convention. I usually buy a couple of prints, but that means that by my third year, I actually have most of their prints.
That's right.
Especially like the ones I really like, I have them all. So I picked up a couple of business cards. One of them is starting a new webcomic I'm going to start reading. A couple other places had webcomics that they were selling collected trades for that looked interesting. But I'm going to read the comic and then maybe next year if I like it.
Exactly.
Go back, buy the volumes. Yeah.
I'm glad you had fun.
I did. It was really, really enjoyable. I think at all times I was with the people that I most wanted to be with at that moment. Usually I was hanging out with two or three people and the group changed over the course of the day, so I wasn't neglecting anyone too much. Now, I was sad that there are a couple of friends from high school who go every year and I try to meet up with them just once or twice, just like run into them and say hi, and I did not this year, which was quite unfortunate. But I did at least get to see, you know, running by me a couple of my favorite cosplayers. There's a one particular cosplayer named Michi who is really awesome, who ran the crossplay panel last year that I really liked. And I saw one of my friends, Kate, who was running around with Michi. Ran into a couple of Doctor Who cosplayers, ran into several Adventure Time cosplayers, got into some cool discussions about my costume and Adventure Time and how awesome it was. But it was pretty chill. I liked it.
Let's wrap up the first part of the show here. We have a nice con-related promo to drop in right here to transition us to second half of the show where we will talk Batman.
Batman.
I'm Batman.
No, I'm Batman.
No, I'm Batman.
I'm Batman, well, and no.
This is Richard Horvitz, and you are listening to the Short Box Showcase.
It's MegaCon, the largest comic book, anime, gaming, and multimedia event in the southeastern U.S. returns. MegaCon, from March 21st through the 23rd, 2014, at the Orange County Convention Center in magical Orlando, Florida. Confirmed comic book guests include Frank Bruner, Neil Adams, Bill Sienkiewicz, Mark Waid, Ron Mars, Greg Land, Michael Golden, Dennis Calero, George Perez, Brandon Peterson, Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti, Colley Hamner, Carl Story, Renee Winterstater, Billy Tucci, and Brian Polito. Just added Nick Bradshaw, Adam Kubert, Dan Jurgens, Mike Miller, Kevin Eastman, Joshua Ortega, Digger, Bart Sears, Ethan Van Sciver, Mike McCone, Frank Thierry, Mike Mayhew, and Chuck Dixon. Confirmed media guests include stars from AMC's The Walking Dead, Torchwood, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Smallville, Battlestar Galactica, Star Wars, Star Trek, and many, many, many more. Plus, I, Scott Gardner, will be there representing the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. Tickets are available online now at www.megaconvention.com. Children 10 and under are free with paid adult ticket. That's MegaCon 2014 at the Orange County Convention Center, Magical Orlando, Florida, March 21st through the 23rd. For information, contact info@megaconvention.com or visit www.megaconvention.com. That's MegaCon 2014. Be there.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, Dad.
We need to record another new trailer.
Another one?
Yes. You know that we read comics and then talk about comics, because as we've established, talking about comics you've not read is just dumb.
Yeah, and you make me do it every Thursday.
Well, we've moved.
Have we?
Yes, we have outgrown our old location.
I don't feel like I've moved.
And we have now moved to twotruefreaks.com.
What was that again?
Twotruefreaks.com. Hey, Kids Comics, still every Thursday at twotruefreaks.com.
And we're back. And we're going to start our occasional series of Batman stories for his 75th birthday.
Yay!
And we're going to start where it started, Detective 27. We're reading this from the copy that my grandfather bought off the newsstand and has put us through... we're not buying this off...
We did not buy this issue off of eBay.
We're reading it from Batman from the 30s to the 70s, a hardcover that I have had for...
Many years.
Let's just say many years.
Many years.
Many decades.
Yes.
Let's leave it at that.
All right.
A couple things to point out about this first story. One, he's not Batman. He's Bat-Man.
Bat-Man.
And there is no origin story.
Mm-mm.
And I think not having an origin story was pretty common for characters from this generation.
Yeah, especially if, you know, you didn't know that this character was necessarily going to take off the way that he did. So you don't have to introduce him and plan the mythos in advance. It just sort of happens over time.
Yeah, you've got 6 pages to tell a story. Why spend 2.5 of it talking about the origin? You want 6 pages of Two-Fisted Man of Action.
Yes.
So the closest we get to an origin is the blurb in the top panel, which will be read to you dramatically by Emily.
The Bat-Man, a mysterious and adventurous figure fighting for righteousness and apprehending the wrongdoer in his lone battle against the evil forces of society. His identity remains unknown. The Case of the Chemical Syndicate.
So by Bob Kane and anonymous, unidentified co-conspirators. For this story, probably Bill Finger. One of the things I liked about this story is that the opening panel, the first panel we ever get in a Batman story, is Bruce Wayne talking to his good buddy, Commissioner Gordon.
At Commissioner Gordon's house.
They're buddies. I like that.
Yeah, it's just a little interesting. They're not meeting down at the station. They're not meeting at Bruce's house. Like, Bruce isn't hosting him. As he has gone to visit somebody. It's nice. It is.
The young socialite.
Which is also interesting because he's a man and a socialite, whereas today we think of socialite as being just female.
He would eventually become a playboy, which
yes,
I guess would be
the equivalent.
So he's hanging out with his good buddy, the commissioner, and they're spending quality manly time smoking cigars.
And pipes, respectively.
As you do.
We hear a ringing on the commissioner's phone, and it turns out that the chemical king, Lambert, was stabbed to death and his son's fingerprints are all over the knife. So he will be right over. And of course, he invites over his good friend, socialite Bruce Wayne, to a crime scene.
Okay, now here's the thing. The first panel of them being buddies, I can actually buy that. If we imagine that Bruce Wayne is a business elite or social elite, it's not crazy that he would hang out with the government elite,
mm-hmm.
whether police commissioner itself is an elected office or appointed by the mayor.
Right.
No, it's a high-powered position in such a large city.
Exactly.
So they actually would perhaps mingle in some social circles, the business community and the political class. that part actually makes some sense. Okay, it's inviting him to the crime scene that might be a little mildly inappropriate on many levels.
Yeah.
But it gets him there. And the son, whose fingerprints are on the knife protruding from his father. I didn't do it. Commissioner, believe me, I didn't do it.
The commissioner tries to calm him down and ask him what actually happened. Son says that he came home early and he heard a groan up in the library, so he rushed there and his father was lying on the floor with a knife in him.
Contract! Contract! And then he died. And that's how the son got his fingerprints on the knife. That's the truth, Commissioner!
So Commissioner Gordon tries to figure out if there was anyone that really wanted this guy dead. Did he have any sort of enemies from his business days or partners that he could talk to?
Not that I know of, except his three former business parties. Let's see. Crane, Rogers, and Stryker. Then there's another call on the phone, and it's Crane who wants to talk to old man Lambert. When he heard that Lambert had been murdered, he wanted to talk to the commissioner. And he has a story of being threatened, so Commissioner Gordon is starting to put the pieces together, that there may be connections between all these gentlemen.
So Commissioner Gordon hangs up the phone and turns to tell all of the policemen that they need to wrap up here, and Bruce says, oh, well, you know, I'll leave you to this. This seems serious. I'm going home. Meanwhile, Stephen Crane is sitting in his library waiting for his impending doom, and suddenly a guy comes out of the other panel and shoots him dead, then rushes to the safe and pulls out a piece of paper, and out the window he goes.
But he is stopped on the roof by the Bat-Hyphen Man.
The Bat-Hyphen Man! He lashes out with a terrific right, grabs the second adversary in a deadly headlock, and with a mighty heave, throws the burly criminal off the roof!
Well, yes, but I'm sure he landed safely.
And softly, and didn't snap his spine. And
I'm sure Batman did not just throw a man to his death on the third page of his introductory comic. Do you know why I know that?
Why?
Because no man with purple gloves would do that.
They are fabulous purple gloves. For better or ill, in this story, you do get the sense that the Bat-Hyphen Man made his own costume. It's kind of like the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man costume before he gets the actual Spider-Man costume, and it's like a hoodie with a thing spray painted on it and gardening gloves that are pulled over a thing, and it works.
Yeah, we haven't met Alfred yet, but you got to imagine Alfred's got to be pretty embarrassed by this getup that his boss is wearing.
Oh, please. This is why the outfit changes. Alfred finds out, is like, Master Bruce, you're not leaving the house dressed like that.
But the Batman does swiftly pick up the paper that the murderer stole from Stephen Crane's safe. Then the commissioner arrives at the same location. It's the Batman! Get him!
And everyone starts shooting at Batman as he takes off into the moon.
That's just an odd perspective shot. He's taking off through the countryside. The moon's just a little bit low in the night sky.
So, the butler comes out and tells the commissioner that Mr. Crane has been murdered. The commissioner and the cops decide, all right, two of the partners have received threats. We have to go and find the third one before he is taken out next. The Bat-Hyphen Man reads the paper as he drives away. Again, no Alfred. No chauffeur. He's got to drive his own car. His own red car. This is no Batmobile.
We're working our way up to the Batmobile.
We're working on it.
Give us time.
Meanwhile, the third partner, Rogers, who has learned of Lambert's death, goes to the final partner, Alfred Stryker. He is greeted by Stryker's looming, green-clad butler.
That can't be bad.
Who hits him in the back of the head, and this man goes down like Tintin.
Okay. Okay, maybe the hulking presence was a bad sign after all.
And so Rogers is tied up by the butler Jennings in the laboratory, which they just happen to have in the basement, as he monologues creepily about getting everyone out of the way so that they can control everything. And
standard villain fare. This is the gas chamber I used to kill guinea pigs to experiment with, but now you are my guinea pig. You fiend! Well, I think that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Jennings pulls down the lever and the glass starts to come down over Rogers with looming doom.
At that moment, the bat hyphen man leaps through an open transom. In the basement?
Is that a house?
Are they in the basement? The house is in the background.
That house... Okay, fine.
Don't you have an open transom to your secret lab basement?
No, because I'm not Ma and Pa Kent.
Well, the Batman seizes a wrench from a table and leaps for the gas chamber, quickly plugs the gas jet with a handkerchief as the gas chamber descends entirely over them. He then unties Rogers and with a powerful swing...
Crash! Shatters the glass. Jennings returns and is startled by the Bat-Hyphen Man. As he reaches for his gun, the Batman greets him with a flying tackle and knocks him unconscious, as the Batman do.
Now, Stryker has heard the crash and runs down to the laboratory. Rogers, what happened? Your assistant Jennings tried to kill me, so he didn't get you after all. Well, I'll finish you and throw your body into the acid tank below.
In the basement?
Below the basement. There's an acid tank below the basement.
The sub-basement.
With a transom above it for leaping. This makes perfect sense.
But he did not notice the Bat-Hyphen Man in the shadows.
Ow! My hand!
And Batman explains the whole plan.
This rat was behind the murders. You see, I learned that you, Lambert, Crane, and Stryker were once partners in the Apex Chemical Corporation. Stryker, who wished to be the sole owner, but having no ready cash, made secret contracts with you to pay a certain sum of money each year till he owned the business. He figured by killing you and stealing the contracts, he wouldn't have to spend that money.
A very clever scheme. And since the contracts were a strict secret between the four of us, our heirs on the outside world wouldn't know a thing about them. But how did you learn all this?
I secured this contract from one of his hired killers.
Suddenly, Stryker pushes himself away from the Batman and pulls a gun, and Batman punches him in the face, and he falls in the acid tank.
A fitting ending for his kind. But he is keeping up his pace. On page 3, he killed a guy, and then on page 6, he killed a guy. So there's a nice rhythm here. Every third page, Batman kills a guy. Kills a villain, and then he escapes through the transom in the basement, into the moon.
And Rogers tries to thank him, but as the Batman do, he's gone. The next day, young Bruce Wayne is again a visitor at the commissioner's house, who finishes telling him the latest exploits of the Bat-Hyphen Man. Bruce Wayne says it's a lovely fairy tale, commissioner. And after Bruce Wayne is gone, the commissioner thinks to himself, Bruce Wayne's a nice young chap, but he certainly must lead a boring life. Seems disinterested in absolutely everything.
Bruce Wayne returns to his room. A little later, his door slowly opens and reveals its occupant. If the commissioner could see his young friend now, he'd be amazed to learn that he is the Bat-Hyphen Man. I mean, I admit, if you didn't know what the spoiler was, it would be a pretty dramatic story.
I agree.
And I kind of like the business angle to it as a business and finance professor.
Indeed.
Mad scientists, I think, are a bit overdone. I like the business motivation behind a criminal plot.
It does make sense, especially if you've got these ideas of taking down organized crime and things like that. I like it. It is a fun story. Now, the first time we mentioned Batman killing a guy, he might have not actually thrown him off the roof, just sort of throw him into the roof and the cops will come and get him. That one's a little iffy. Being thrown bodily into tank of acid, which fans of the animated series will recognize as being appropriated for the death of the Red Hood and the origin of the Joker.
Batman plus villain plus acid, it doesn't always turn out as quote-unquote good as it did in this story. It often comes back to haunt him.
Yeah.
So I guess there is a sense of comeuppance, perhaps, which is reasonable. I love the fact that we have Commissioner Gordon.
Yes.
Right off the bat. Now, I knew he was early. Catwoman is very early in the Batman's history. Joker is also pretty early. I did not realize that literally the first panel
was Commissioner Gordon.
Had Commissioner Gordon in it. That's awesome. And it's easy with modern eyes and with all the things we know of Batman to make fun of it a little bit.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The things we're making fun of, like the purple gloves, are, to be fair, pretty minor things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a good story overall. It's a little silly. It's very kind of over the top and a little campy, but it's a very fun story for its time.
But you can see where a story like this would cause a character like this to catch on.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was a really good introduction, certainly for comics of that era. Well-paced story, moved fast.
And I do also like that they do reveal at the end who the Batman is. That they set up Bruce Wayne as a character, they set up Commissioner Gordon, and they have a little mystery just for that first issue. But then they set up the status quo at the end by the audience will know Bruce Wayne is Batman. No one else knows this. And when you read the next story, then you will know Bruce Wayne is Batman. We'll get to see more of Bruce Wayne.
One of the things about secret identities is that it's an old trick in any sort of fiction, especially in mystery or detective fiction, which really, you know, Batman starts off as, is the idea that the reader knows more than some of the characters.
Right.
So there's that notion with that reveal on the last page that automatically you know more than Commissioner Gordon does.
Right.
And that's obviously proven in superheroes to really be an effective sort of narrative hook for readers. Not quite sure what other Batman stories we're going to do over the next year, but I think every couple of episodes or so we'll tackle a little bit of the Dark Knight detective, so.
Or his greater mythos and adaptations, perhaps?
Adaptations. Hmm. I like where you're going with this.
Back to the well.
So, Batman, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Batman. If you have any feedback for us, you can email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or you can search for us on iTunes, leave a rating and review. Check out our website at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
And most importantly, thanks for listening.
Bye, guys.
And if you have any feedback...
That's what I was wondering. So I was like, I didn't know if we were going to do
we
that.
We could do that again.
I didn't know if we were going to do that, or if we were going to, and then sort of stop and then do the thing, or whatever. So,
We ended up with Happy Birthday, Batman. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So, Emily, I'll talk to you next time we have a show.
All right, cool. See you next week.
Or maybe I'll chat with you sometime between now and then. Who knows, but...
Meh. What was the other one that I went to? I went to the Tokusatsu. I went to that one. Oh.
Here's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
In the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
a lot of YA paranormal romance type fantasy. Is it... Do you think it's scratching the same itch? Or are they different?
No. Actually, not very much at all. It's much more a girl version of superheroes.
All right, last question or two about Ahayacon 2014.
No, we've got more to talk about, I'm sure. But...
Well, I've just got the time and what else to do? I was going to ask you about what you bought and the...
You were going to ask me about what a magical girl is. You were going to ask, like...
Well, I could ask that.
There's more to talk about.
Okay.
The first 7 minutes are only 2 minutes. Remember that.
That is true, too. We're probably only at 20 minutes now. But
yeah.
We do have a Batman thing to talk about, too.
We won't talk about that for long.
I like it.
It's six pages.
I like it.
Okay.
Ba-ba-ba-ba.
By Rob Kane, which I think is just a...
Well, I think it's supposed to be Robert.
Oh, yes, I know. But I'm just saying... I think it's interesting that he's listed as Rob Kane instead of Bob Kane, as we all know him now.
Well, you know why it's robbed. Because that's what he did to Bill Finger. He robbed him.
Oh!
Okay, I'm actually not going to keep that in there, but... I just thought of that at the end.
Blooper.